Dr. Zelenko, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank
Great.
You so much for having me.
Nice to meet you. How are you?
Thank God, I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, well, under the circumstances, we're doing fine, I think. And I think we're about to turn this thing around. I don't know if you've listened in on what Vera Sharaf and Ilana Rachel Daniels said. This is becoming so outrageous. It's almost as though they're taking off their masks and letting us see what monsters they are on the other side.
Yeah, I think now the enemies of humanity are so brazen and so confident in themselves that they don't even bother concealing their agenda.
Yeah. Well, can you introduce yourself to our audience? I know who you are. I've read up on you. I know you're a very famous person, but some of our viewers may not.
My name is Dr. Vladimir Zev Zelenko, mm-hmm. And I'm a board-certified family physician for the last 20 years. I worked in upstate New York, in a community of 35,000 people that live in a square mile of each other, very high population density. And in March of last year, COVID arrived and spread through the community. And I found myself in the middle of the worst, the first and worst outbreak of COVID in America. And we had thousands of patients sick. At that point, there was no treatment. The only advice we were giving patients is take Tylenol, go home. When you get short of breath, go to the hospital, end up on a respirator. And the statistics in March and April, at least in New York, were on 80%, more than 80% of people on a respirator died. So that was the treatment model. all the governing bodies were saying to not treat anything until the illness progressed. As of today, even the NIH recommendations for the treatment of COVID are not to intervene at all unless the patient is in the hospital with a oxygen level less than 92. That's after 18 months of evidence that pre-hospital intervention reduces hospitalization and death by 85%. Mm-hmm. My data set was the first in the world. Two colleagues from Germany reached out to me, Dr. Roland Derwand. He's works for the life science industry, and Dr. Martin Schulz, who's a professor of biology in one of the universities in Germany. And they offered their help to bring my data to the world, which we did. It was published in an internationally renowned peer-reviewed journal. And it was a foundational paper that became the basis of other people's research. So my paper showed the following, that if you risk stratify patients into high and low risk, and you intervene in high risk patients who have a 7.5% mortality rate globally, if you intervene in the first few days of the onset of symptoms of COVID, with an antiviral combination approach, you reduce hospitalization by 84%. Subsequently, dozens of studies have corroborated these observations from all around different continents and world-class researchers that it really doesn't really matter which protocol you use. It matters when you use it and who you give it to. So just to give you a sense of scale, in America, let's say we have 600,000 dead Americans, we could have prevented 510,000 hospitalizations and deaths. That's the sense of scale of what we're dealing with. And this is a medical fact at this point. When you have over three dozen studies all saying the following, you intervene early in high-risk patients and you reduce death by 85%. It's pretty pathetic when common sense is considered genius. Because all I did is suggest that we intervene early in a disease process, which is the paradigm that we use in medicine. You look at the CDC itself, when it comes to influenza virus, the recommendation is to start antiviral treatment within 48 hours of the onset of symptoms, because that's when it works. You look at someone who has cancer, God forbid. We don't wait until it spreads and becomes metastatic disease. We treat it while it's localized. because it's easier to treat. Except when it came to COVID-19, to this day, the governing bodies are discouraging, in various ways, pre-hospital intervention. So that's how I got involved. It's not like I chose COVID, it chose me. And they say that necessity is the mother of all innovation. And I found myself in a community that I've been taking care of for 20 years. And I was once told that I'm a family member to 4,000 families. So I felt responsible and I had skin in the game. I really cared about my patients and they were dying and I had nothing to offer them. So through innovation, and with God's grace, I came across a protocol that works. When I realized that, I made a video addressed to the President of the United States. 16 hours later, and I released it on YouTube, 16 hours later, Mark Meadows, the President's Chief of Staff, called me on my cell phone. I wanted to know what I needed, what I wanted, and I expressed to him my observations. And again, it was very early in the process, so I treated perhaps only 100 patients at that time. And he told me that they're interested and they want to be updated with my data. So I had Mark Meadows' cell phone and email, and I gave him weekly updates. Two weeks later, Stephen Hahn from the commissioner of the FDA called me on my cell phone, and he was interested in what I was doing. Obviously, he got my number from Mark Meadows. And then he got me connected with the head people in the NIH. And that was a dead end, because what happened was I had generated real world evidence. I wasn't doing research. I was treating my patients, but in the process of treating my patients in a novel way, I saw remarkable results. So this is not clinical trial data. This is not pharmaceutically sponsored clinical trials or academic clinical trials. This was simple real world evidence that, in my opinion, had profound value. By way of analogy, imagine a frontline soldier discovers an enemy map. The map has the locations of the enemy. He realizes that this map could help win the war. He needs to get it to the five-star general. So there's no time to go through the regular chain of command. So the NIH had no mechanism in place, nor any desire to process real-world evidence. And that has to do with an attitude that was fermented in academia and through the pharmaceutical industry, that only clinical trial data has any validity. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, 2019, which invalidated and marginalized real-world evidence in lieu of clinical trial data. What essentially that did was give the pharmaceutical industry and academia a monopoly on medical truth. And since there's no firewall between the FDA, NIH, CDC, and WHO from the pharmaceutical industry, and most of the executives of these three word organizations end up after their tenure working for the pharmaceutical industry, there's a clear conflict of interest. So, for example, the previous commissioner of the FDA, his name is Scott Gottlieb, I believe worked as an advisor to either Pfizer or Moderna. I forget which one. And Stephen Hahn, the last commissioner of the FDA, also works for one of those companies. They work for different companies, but I forget who was who. But one of them works for Pfizer, one of them works for Moderna. So how can you have a agency whose purpose is to protect the public? We fund them in theory, and their interests do not lie in protecting the people of the country, but rather serving the interests of their masters and stakeholders. So I stumbled across, and I have many examples of corruption that borders on genocide. And I'd like to share that information with you because I believe it has legal ramifications.
Allow me to quickly translate so that our viewers who don't speak English, some of them don't speak English, will know what you're talking about. Also ist ein Hausarzt in upstate New York, also im nördlichen New York, in einer Gemeinde mit 35.000 Einwohnern, die alle sehr eng zusammenwohnen, auf wenig Raum zusammenwohnen, also sehr eng beieinander sind.
Wenig
Quadratmeter, genau. Und er wird da inzwischen als Hausarzt von 4.000 Familien angesehen. Es gab da zu Beginn der Pandemie viele Covid-Fälle. Und da hat er gemerkt, dass wenn die Leute dann an Beatmungsmaschinen angeschlossen wurden, mehr als 80% gestorben sind. Er selber hat gesagt, das muss auch anders gehen, hatte auch Kontakt zu zwei deutschen Ärzten, die dann geholfen haben, seine Daten zu veröffentlichen. Er hat mit seiner Strategie, nach Risikogruppen zu behandeln, eine 84-prozentige Reduktion in der Hospitalisation hingekriegt. Er sagt, wenn man vernünftig gehandelt hätte, also von Anfang an das Richtige getan hätte, anstatt das zu tun, was wir jetzt gerade gesehen haben, dann wären statt 600.000 Leute nur etwa 90.000 gestorben. 510.000 Hospitalisationen und Tote hätten vermieden werden können. By the way, this is the same thing that Knut Witkowski says, told us. He says that if they had done the right thing, instead of pushing these anti-corona measures, which are deadly, instead of 600,000 people or deaths, there would have been 50,000. He comes from a different angle, but he arrives at the same conclusion. Innerhalb von 48 Stunden müsste man, sagt er, die Symptome mit antiviralen viraler Medikation bekämpfen, dann würde es helfen. Auch bei Krebs würde man ja nicht abwarten, bis es besonders schlimm wird, sondern man behandelt sofort. Er hat ein Video zu seiner Behandlungsmethode verfasst. Das ist dann an den damaligen Stabschef des Weißen Hauses, Mark Meadows, gegangen. Der rief 16 Stunden später an und hat dann die Verbindung zum NIH, also zum National Institute of Health, herbeigeführt. Das war dann eine Sackgasse, weil da, sagt er, hatten die keinerlei Interesse. Er hat ja keine Studie gemacht, sondern er hat einfach nur seine Beobachtungen mitgeteilt. Sie hatten kein Interesse an Real-World Evidence, sondern nur an klinischen Studien. Das ganze Setup des NIH, auch dokumentiert in einem Artikel im New England Journal of Medicine, ist so, dass sie nur klinische Studien, peer-reviewed klinische Studien ernst nehmen, sonst nichts hören und sehen wollen. Sagt die FDA, NIH und CDC, alle drei sind so eng verflochten mit der pharmazeutischen Industrie, dass man keinen Unterschied mehr sehen kann. Ein Beispiel ist Stephen Hahn, der durch diese Revolving Door, kann man sagen, hin und her marschiert hat, das haben wir nun schon oft gehört, diese faktische Übernahme der öffentlichen Institutionen, FDA ist übrigens eine privat erfundene Institution aus 1913 und der NIH und CDC, das ist durch die pharmazeutische Industrie, das ist inzwischen so, so durchdringend, dass man keinen Unterschied mehr sehen kann. By the way, I was just going to mention, there is a colleague of yours from Texas, his name is Brian Artis, Dr. Brian Artis, and he explains in a video that I saw a couple of days ago, two things. One, many of the deaths in New York, and he's talking about New York City, many of the deaths in New York, most of them, in fact, could have been avoided had Fauci not issued a rule or, I guess it was almost a mandate to the doctors to use a medication called remdesivir. Remdesivir, which he explains in this video, Fauci knows was kicked out of a number of studies because it's deadly. Remdesivir was supposedly the new gold standard for treatment. And he says that 84, 85% of the deaths after treatment in New York City was due to this drug, due to remdesivir. Another thing he tells us is that in October of 2020, before the so-called vaccinations started, the CDC knew all of the side effects that we're now seeing, the blood clotting, the autoimmune responses, et cetera, all of them in detail. And he has a list of them on his website. I looked it up. It's true. Nevertheless, they started with the vaccinations. Is it so, Dr. Zelenko, that you would advise to listen more to the people who are on the forefront, meaning family doctors, for example, who really are in touch with the patients rather than medical institutions, which, as you explained, have largely been taken over in a hostile takeover by the pharmaceutical industry?
So I'm going to give you the exact evolution and details of everything you just said, but in much higher level of resolution. Mm-hmm. You have to understand who you're talking to. My team has treated 6,000 patients with COVID successfully. Three died out of 6,000 when statistically we were expecting a few hundred. My data was the inspiration behind Dr. Peter McCullough, George Farid, Brian Tyson, Dr. Harvey Riesch. They all testified by the Senate that my work was the foundation of theirs. We as a group now have trained other physicians. We're now in the hundreds, maybe even a thousand physicians who cumulatively have treated millions of patients successfully. So from that perspective of pre-hospital expertise and being the one that actually developed the protocol, I'm going to answer you in the following way. That remdesivir, the only way remdesivir could have been used is in the following way. When President Trump issued an executive order that every American should have access to hydroxychloroquine, that order was given to Secretary Azar. Secretary Azar gave that order to Larry Kudlow, who was the head counsel for Health and Human Services. Larry Kudlow called Dr. Rick Bright from the HHS, who was the head of BARDA, B-A-R-D-A, the prime branch involved in vaccine research. How do I know all this? Dr. Bright himself, in his own words, says this in a documentary called Totally Under Control. I was in this documentary, and the segment right before mine, Dr. Bright speaks, and he gleefully admits to and walks through the mechanics of genocide. So in his own words, it'd be worth your while to review it. So what does he say? He says the following, that he and his team at BARDA did not agree with the president's directive. So they came up with a creative solution where instead of using the right to try pathway that the government had established or the compassionate access care program, which essentially gives access to patients to medication outside of clinical trials under certain circumstances. Senator Ron Johnson was the one that advocated for this legislation. Instead of using that pathway, which would have made hydroxychloroquine accessible to every American in the outpatient setting, they crafted an emergency use authorization that restricted hydroxychloroquine access to hospitalized patients. I'll say that again. The President of the United States gave an order that every single American should have access. By the way, when the President of the United States announced that he's taking hydroxychloroquine, he mentioned that he got a letter from a doctor from upstate New York advising him. So that was my letter. And so I had influenced the president's thinking when it came to the efficacy and safety of hydroxychloroquine to such a degree that he himself was willing to take it. And he felt that every single American should have access. And by the way, I've noticed whatever the FDA decides, the rest of the world follows. So in a sense, we had an opportunity to scale hydroxychloroquine or early pre-hospital treatment globally. This would have ended the study. But instead, and there's a Dr. Stephen Hatzfeld. He worked with Dr. Peter Navarro, who was president's economic advisor. And Dr. Stephen Hatzfeld did an interview and wrote an article explaining exactly what happened with this executive use authorization. Apparently, Janet Woodcock, who is currently the acting commissioner of the FDA under Biden, but at that point, under the Trump administration, had a senior position in the FDA, reached out in a very unusual, highly unusual way from the FDA to the HHS and collaborated together with Dr. Rick Bright to come up with the idea of how to restrict hydroxychloroquine access to only hospitalized patients and not to the outpatient setting, essentially killing the approach of treating this infection early. Now, exactly what the emergency use authorization did was open the national stockpile of hydroxychloroquine to whoever the emergency use authorization would have given it to. So that national stockpile was opened only to hospitalized patients. So in reality, any doctor could still have used it legally, because in America, any drug that's FDA approved may be used off-label for any reason, if the doctor feels that that's appropriate. However, the wording of the emergency use authorization had implied and confused, including myself, every single doctor in America, because it sounded like it was not being approved for use in the outpatient setting. And what that did, since most physicians in America are now employed by larger institutions, hospital systems, the hospital systems placed restrictions onto their employees, the physicians, whether or not they could use this medication. And they limited its use to only a hospital setting. So in effect, what was created was an artificial obstacle for the access, the exact opposite of the intention of the President of the United States, to make it available to every American and hence every human being on the planet. Rather, it was undermined, sabotaged in the way I just described. And since we know that pre-hospital treatment could have reduced hospitalization and death by 85%, that means these people, this order, this trick that they played, is directly responsible for the genocide that is happening worldwide. Now, I have to give you more information. Now, we're going to get to remdesivir in a minute.
Hang on one second, because we have to translate. And also, Wolfgang wants to ask you a question. Let me quickly translate. Ich glaube, Wolfgang, im Ergebnis wird man ihm wahrscheinlich recht geben können, wenn man sagt, dass die Beschränkung der Behandlung mit Hydroxychloroquin, wo wir gleich drauf kommen, nur für bereits erkrankte, hospitalisierte Patienten wahrscheinlich wirklich tödlich war. Aber ich will, bevor du die Frage stellst, Wolfgang, lass mich kurz übersetzen. Warte mal, wo waren wir hier? Ach ja, Er hat mit seinem Team von Ärzten 6000 Patienten erfolgreich behandelt. Nur 6 davon sind gestorben. Andere haben das übernommen. Zum Beispiel Peter McCullough hat das übernommen. Aber auch andere Ärzte haben inzwischen millionenfach, so hat er es eben geschildert, erfolgreich seine Behandlungsmethode angewendet. Ich habe nach Remdesivir gefragt, da kommt gleich noch was. Als Antwort, er sagt, und habe darauf hingewiesen, dass ein anderer Arzt, den wir hoffentlich bald hier hören werden, Brian Ardis, nämlich aus Texas, gesagt hat, die Behandlung mit Remdesivir hat in New York, die ist empfohlen worden von Fauci, man weiß aber, und auch Fauci weiß, dass Remdesivir faktisch tödlich ist, ist aus mehreren Studien rausgeflogen, weil die Teilnehmer, die Remdesivir bekommen haben, schwerste Probleme einschließlich Tod erlitten haben. Dieser Brian Ardis hat gesagt, das hat locker 85% der Menschen in New York das Leben gekostet. Diese Behandlung, die von Fauci empfohlen wurde, obwohl er wusste, dass es tödlich ist. Er hat außerdem gesagt, dass die CDC kurz vor dem Beginn der Impfung genau wussten und im Detail aufgelistet hat, kann man bei ihm auf der Website nachlesen, welche Nebenwirkungen in Anführungsstrichen diese Impfungen haben würden, einschließlich Tod, einschließlich Autoimmunerkrankungen, schließlich Thrombosen. Dr. Zelenko hat sich auf diese Hydroxychloroquin-Geschichte nochmal gestützt, sagt, es hat der Präsident ihn angehört, das ging über verschiedene Kanäle. Azar ist einer der Gesundheitsminister gewesen, Larry Kudlow ist der und Peter Navarro ist ein Wirtschaftsberater gewesen. Da hat Präsident Trump am Ende eine Executive Use Authorization, kann man sagen, rausgegeben, hat gesagt, jedem Bürger in den USA muss der Zugang zu Hydroxychloroquin möglich sein. Das hat aber die BARDA-Truppe, Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority heißt das, umgemünzt. Die haben sich dagegen gewendet und haben gesagt, ja, kann man machen, aber nur der Zugang für Hydroxychloroquin nur für bereits Hospitalisierte, also für auch bereits erkrankte Menschen. Und ich glaube, daran hat Wolfgang damals auch immer seine Kritik aufgehängt. Das hat hier dann anstatt Prävention, das hat dann zu erheben, weil Trump hat ja auch das Zeug genommen. Ne? Das hat jedenfalls zu erheblichem Chaos geführt. Nun gibt es zwar, sagt er, die Möglichkeit für niedergelassene Ärzte, also Hausärzte, auch nach ihrer eigenen Entscheidung auch sowas wie Hydroxychloroquin anders zu verwenden, das ist ja eigentlich ein Antimalariamittel, anders zu verwenden, also off-label, als es eigentlich vorgesehen ist, wenn sie es denn medizinisch für vertretbar halten. Nur, das Problem ist, dass die meisten Hausärzte inzwischen Angestellte großer medizinischer Konzerne sind und die haben genau diese Meinung vertreten und genau diese Meinung der BARDA von wegen, man darf das nur den bereits im Krankenhaus liegenden Patienten zugänglich machen. Die haben sich das zu eigen gemacht, sodass auf diese Weise das, was Trump eigentlich vorhatte, nämlich jedem diese Präventivmaßnahme zu gewähren, ins Gegenteil verkehrt wurde und diese Behandlung dann nur noch mit bereits Kranken erfolgte. Aber Wolfgang, ich will dich nicht abschneiden, weil deine Frage ist mit Sicherheit wichtig.
Ja, ich höre das Ganze mit ziemlicher Skepsis, muss ich sagen, weil wir haben ja viele Hausärzte, die Patienten behandeln. Und nicht nur in New York, sondern auf der ganzen Welt gibt es Menschen, die diese Symptomatik haben, die Covid-19 dann auch zugeschrieben wurde, vor allen Dingen im Frühjahr vorigen Jahres. Und erstmal muss ich die Kritik wiederholen, dass meistens kaum eine Differentialdiagnose gemacht wurde bei den meisten Patienten. Also es wurde nicht gleichzeitig getestet, welche anderen Viren dann noch eine Rolle spielen. Und es wurde die Symptomatik, wie sie sonst bei der Grippe besteht, wurde getestet und dann wurde dann die Diagnose aufgrund des PCR-Tests meistens dann gestellt. Das ist etwas, das ist voreilig, das halte ich für falsch. Mhm. Und dann, wenn man jetzt als Hausarzt eine Studie macht, ist das große Problem, auch wenn man jetzt mehrere Leute in der Praxis hat, das große Problem mit der Kontrollgruppe, das große Problem mit dem Selection Bias. Das heißt, dass man aufpassen muss, dass man seinen Patienten gut nicht selektiert und dadurch die Ergebnisse dann eben völlig auch verzerrt. Es gibt ja auch entsprechende Kritik. Und ich kenne andere Ärzte, die behaupten, sie hätten die Welt gerettet mit Ivermectin. Ich kenne Leute, die sagen, man hätte frühzeitig eine Mundspülung machen müssen mit desinfizierenden Mitteln. Also es gibt sehr, sehr viele solche Tipps, die möglicherweise alle irgendwie was für sich haben. Aber wenn man rausfinden will als Arzt, ob das wirklich in Ordnung ist oder als Wissenschaftler, und das bedarf ja einer wissenschaftlichen Fundierung, dann muss man sowas eigentlich randomisiert machen. Da darf man erstmal seinen Patientengut nicht auswählen. Ich hab gelesen, die Studie von Herrn Zelenko, da waren das insgesamt 400 Patienten und bei 140 Patienten hat er dann das ausprobiert. Was ist mit den anderen Patienten gewesen? Weshalb kamen die nicht in den Genuss? Und wo ist die Kontrollgruppe? Das sind also Sachen, die mir völlig unklar sind. Deshalb glaube ich das erstmal nicht. Ich bin skeptisch, weil ich vom Beruf als Wissenschaftler skeptisch sein muss und auch zum Schutze meiner Patienten skeptisch sein muss. Und ich denke, da bedarf es wirklich klinischer Studien, bei denen erstmal klar sein muss, was wird da behandelt. Ist es wirklich eine Covid-19-Entzündung, also eine Infektion, die für diese Symptome verantwortlich ist und dann für welche Symptome? Worauf spricht dann der Patient dann an nachher? Was wird besser, was wird nicht besser? Wie alt waren die Patienten? All diese Dinge. Und das gibt also unheimlich viele Studien, die haben nicht auf die Confounder geachtet. Das heißt, welche sonstigen Faktoren spielen eine Rolle bei der Beeinflussung der Ergebnisse? Und das sind alles Dinge, da muss ich sagen, das, was ich gelernt habe, die kritische Haltung, die ich gelernt habe in Bezug auf die Wirkung von Medikamenten, die mich ja zum unliebsamen Gesprächspartner für die pharmazeutische Industrie gemacht haben in vielen Jahren, die kann ich hier nicht verlassen. Meine kritische Haltung behalte ich bei. Und die Befunde, die hier vorliegen, halte ich für unzureichend. Ich würde meine Patienten nicht mit dieser Medikation behandeln. Ich glaube schon, dass Hydroxychloroquin in der Dosis, zweimal 200 Milligramm gegeben, das ist relativ hoch. Aber es gibt durchaus Rheuma-Patienten, die so behandelt werden. Das werden ja, Hydroxychloroquin wird ja kaum noch benutzt bei Malaria, sondern wird jetzt sehr viel bei Rheuma benutzt. Und aber dass dazu dann noch eben diese Azithromycin, Antibiotikum, was auch sonst sehr viel angewandt wird. Das war wahrscheinlich deshalb gegeben, um irgendwelche bakteriellen Superinfektionen zu vermeiden. Das ist eigentlich nicht Legeartes, denn man behandelt mit Antibiotika wirklich nur, wenn man weiß, dass es eine bakterielle Infektion ist. Man gibt nicht einfach Antibiotika bei einer Grippe und auch nicht bei einer Infektion, wo man nicht weiß, welche Viren da eine Rolle spielen. Zinksulfat schadet sicher nichts, da kann ich nichts zu sagen, das macht sicher sehr nützlich sein, macht immer nützlich sein. Aber insgesamt Hydroxychloroquin einfach so zu geben, ich würde es meinen Patienten nicht geben. Deshalb bin ich da sehr, sehr skeptisch und verlange dann und bin ja nicht allein damit. Ich weiß, dass es also auch die Auswertung gegeben hat. Ich habe dem nochmal nachgeguckt hier in Deutschland im Arzneitelegramm, auch da wird es sehr skeptisch gesehen. Also ich glaube, dass wir haben das sehr viel, dass Menschen von dem, was sie gemacht haben, überzeugt sind. Und die müssen sich aussetzen der wissenschaftlichen Kritik. Und das gehört dazu. Und das hat mit persönlichem Image und Ehrgeiz gar nichts zu tun. Es geht um die Sache, es geht um die Dinge, die man beobachten will. Es geht um mögliche Fehlerquellen. Und die wissenschaftliche Methode ist hier gut definiert. Evidenzbasierte Medizin sieht anders aus. Von daher bin ich hier skeptisch, kann die Empfehlung nicht nachvollziehen.
Okay. Soll ich mal übersetzen oder wollen wir uns lieber höflich zurückhalten? Nein, das war ein Witz. Ich übersetze das.
Du kannst es höflich übersetzen.
Natürlich. Dr. Zelenko, Dr. Vodak expresses some skepticism about the approach that, as you described it. And of course, this is not personal. This is because he's looking at it from his own doctor's perspective. And his question is, how did you arrive at the diagnosis of COVID? Did you use a differential diagnosis, or did you rely on the PCR test results? And the other question, or the other area of skepticism, is that there are a few people out there, not just Dr. Vodak, who do think that even though there may be some advantages to the treatment of with hydroxychloroquine, which used to be an anti-malaria medication, and now it's it's probably used in other areas. But there are a lot of people who believe that it may be good for prevention, but what about using it for the treatment of patients who show symptoms? So those are his two points of skepticism. What do you think?
So I will answer each one in depth. I just have one question. What is the expertise of the good doctor, and how many COVID patients has he treated?
Oh, he's a specialist. He's been in the business for, I think, 40 years or so, and he's a lung specialist. He has run a public institute of health in the northern part of Germany in a town called Flensburg. He's the one who stopped the swine flu some 11 years ago because he was then in the position of political power. He was a member of the German parliament, and he was a member of the Council of Europe, and he was able to force the pharmaceutical industry to drop their mask and to finally admit that this, back then, the swine flu is nothing more than a mild flu. So that's why he's skeptical again, and why he...
How many patients has he treated with COVID-19 in the outpatient setting?
None. COVID-19 is too new. I didn't study them. I didn't treat them. But okay. Let me finish, please.
You already spoke. Now it's my turn to answer. You spoke very. I thought this was going to be an interview with. If this is going to turn into a debate, I'll love it. I wouldn't be even happier. But now it's my turn to respond. Okay. So first of all, I find it very interesting that people with no experience in this COVID-19 crisis are hypercritical. Now, keep in mind, I was not doing research. This was a brand new pandemic that was global, and no one knew anything. So, of course...
How do you know it is a pandemic? How do you find it out?
Well, that's what our governing bodies were saying. They were shutting down. The world economy was shut down. What do you mean?
Yes, that's right. But this was... They spoke about the pandemic when there was a swine flu, and it was no pandemic.
Tell me, let me know when to come back if you want to hear yourself speak. If you want to listen to what I have to say, then it's my turn to talk right now.
Okay, go on.
Okay, I'm trying to explain to you my state of mind and thinking and rationale that led me on a certain course of action. Okay, all the governing bodies were scaring the entire world that this is a unknown new global crisis, so much so that the American economy was shut down.
All the world's economies were shut down. Mm.
A simple physician from upstate New York obviously is going to take this seriously. But my point was there was no established treatment for it. And I had to deal with thousands of sick patients on the ground. I'm not playing theoretical games here, okay? I was dealing with human beings. There's something called the circle of empathy. I was dealing, keeping people above the ground, not so the worms will eat them, okay? So what do you do when there is no answer? Well, I could rely on the academics and wait 6 to 12 months until they get around to a clinical trial that may be helpful. Or maybe you improvise. This is World War III, where more than 200 countries are dealing with the same invisible enemy that was artificially produced. No one's denying the fact that they took a benign animal virus, made it infectious to human beings, then augmented its destructive power for the lungs, and then spread it globally. This is an artificial bioweapon. Everyone's agreeing to this. 18 months ago, conspiracy theorists. Now, just conspiracy, but not a theory. The conspiracy to commit genocide, actually. So,
yes, but
one second. I am not finished. I will finish, and then you can ask your questions. So, what I did was I innovated. I started thinking outside of the box. I looked at episode 34 on MedCram on YouTube, where the professor there explains the role of zinc ionophores with zinc. And how they work, how zinc inhibits RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase turns out to be the essential enzyme involved in RNA viral replication. All the strains of COVID, all the strains of influenza, and it turns out RSV as well. Then I looked how South Korea had treated these patients, and they used hydroxychloroquine and zinc with in hospitalized patients with some minor success. Then I looked at how Dr. Didier Raoul in Marseille, France, was treating patients. He was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, no zinc, with some success. So I said to myself, you know what? Why don't I take all the available evidence, put it together, tweak the dosing to reflect less severe patients, and administer it, and let's see what happens. I'll give you an analogy. Imagine you're drowning in the ocean and you see a piece of driftwood. Now, I don't have a clinical trial to tell me that that piece of driftwood may save my life, but you better believe I'm going to hold on to it. And you know what? If I do survive, I'm going to tell other people about it. That's exactly what happened. The second I started using this approach, people stopped going to the hospital. Now, by the way, I don't have to convince you now. There are dozens of studies that corroborate what I'm saying. Well, I'm not going back 18 months to prove something that's already been proven. Okay? So, and I did publish my data with two German world-class scientists in a peer-reviewed journal, which has now been quoted 200 times as the basis of all the research. And other physicians. Good. So, let me finish. And by the way, that was not a study. That was a report of real-world evidence. It was not, there was no clinical design. This was just a simple doctor practicing simple medicine. Now, let me explain something to you. I didn't finish my, you asked me about remdesivir. I was getting to it. There was a tremendous amount of academic fraud, coordinated academic fraud. The academic peer review process has lost all legitimacy. When the Lancet study that reported a meta-analysis of 96,000 patients based on Surgisphere's data was published that showed that hydroxychloroquine kills people, the World Health Organization took that paper and made a global moratorium on the use and research of hydroxychloroquine. Then, subsequently, it turned out that that entire data set was fraud, that it didn't exist, and Lancet, in the biggest scandal and embarrassment in the history of science, had to retract a paper that was based on, it was less valuable than used toilet paper. It was absolute fraud. If you look at the recovery trial, sponsored by Oxford University, they concluded that hydroxychloroquine killed 25% of the patients that were taking it. Well, you know what? That was true. But one little detail. They used 2,400 milligrams of hydroxychloroquine a day per patient. That's enough to kill an elephant. I was advocating for 400 milligrams. So they used six times the recommended dose. You think people will die? All that paper proves is if you poison someone with homicidal and lethal dosing, they will die.
Yes.
Same thing happened with the Solidarity trial, where they used 2,000 milligrams. And if you look at the VA study that came out of Virginia, all that study showed was that hydroxychloroquine kills people, those people that have been on a ventilator for 17 days. And from that, they concluded that it won't work in the first phase. By the way, I'm not a hydroxychloroquine doctor. It doesn't matter. I'm a zinc ionophore doctor. It's been all the data has shown that if you increase intracellular zinc enough, it will inhibit RNA virus replication. The problem is zinc, for biochemical reasons, cannot enter the cell. It has a +2 charge. It's dissolved in aqueous solution. The cell membrane is a biphospholipid lipid. So you need a transport mechanism to get zinc from outside the cell to inside the cell. There are classes of drugs called zinc ionophores. It turns out one of them is hydroxychloroquine. But there's also ivermectin. There's also quercetin. There's also EGCG. It's not, it doesn't matter to me which one you use, as long as you, it's a gun and a bullet. If you, the bullet is zinc, kills the virus. If you, but a bullet without a gun is useless, and a gun without a bullet is useless. So all those studies that use hydroxychloroquine without zinc were designed to fail. Because if I give you an unloaded gun and you can't and you come back to me and tell me the gun is broken, that's not a reasonable conclusion. The reasonable conclusion is you didn't give me the full set to have a working system. Okay, so now we've established academic fraud. So in the first week of June, listen to this, the FDA revokes the emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine. If you look at the document that is the basis for that to happen, they quote the Lancet study after it's already been retracted as the basis for revoking the emergency use authorization. In other words, they took a piece of garbage, fraudulent document that's responsible for the death of millions of people, and it was already retracted, and they still used it as a basis to revoke the use of hydroxychloroquine. And then I found out why. I got my hands on internal FDA documents. And there's a policy that the FDA has on who can get an emergency use authorization. By the way, do you know what an emergency use authorization is? Yeah. It's a gold mine for the pharmaceutical, because it takes 10 years to get a drug to market and millions of dollars in fees, right? But if there are certain criteria and guidelines when a drug could be brought to market under emergency situation, like an unknown pandemic. So it turned out that if there is an existing therapeutic that already works, no other drug can get an emergency use authorization, because then it has to go through the regular FDA development process. So hydroxychloroquine's emergency use authorization was a technical legal obstacle for other drugs to get emergency use authorization. So what happened? They used a fraudulent document. They revoked the emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine. And guess what? 3 weeks later, remdesivir gets an emergency use authorization and a $3 billion contract. Now, what was remdesivir's emergency use authorization based on? There were four studies. One study out of those four showed a reduction in hospital stay from 15 days to 10 days, a reduction in hospitalization by one third, but no survival benefit. And by the way, I'm not knocking that. That may be significant. But the fact is, we were showing an 84% reduction in hospitalization and death with early intervention with hydroxychloroquine, and they remove that and give it to a drug that has no survival benefit, and one out of four studies shows that it may reduce hospitalization by a third. And if you look at the package insert of remdesivir, it says 6% of people get a heart arrhythmia called atrial fibrillation. 23% of people get liver dysfunction. 15% of people get kidney dysfunction. So this, and here's the beautiful thing. Remdesivir could only be used in the hospital. It's an IV medication. Hydroxychloroquine, which costs 20 cents a pill, is oral, could be used at home. So if you reduce a hospitalization by 84%, you reduce the market share of remdesivir by 84%. Yeah. Now you can ask it.
Let me translate first. Also, als Wolfgang gefragt hat, weil er sagte, ja, ich musste ja was machen, weil es gab ja hier weltweit diese Pandemie. Hat Wolfgang gefragt, woher wissen Sie denn, dass es eine Pandemie gab? Weil er sich, wie wir eben alle gesehen haben, aufgeregt und gesagt, ja, aber die haben noch die Wirtschaft in den USA dicht gemacht. Und was soll man denn da machen, außer sich jetzt erstmal um die Patienten kümmern? Inzwischen sei ja völlig klar, dass es sich bei dem Virus um eine künstliche Biowaffe handelt da muss er eben irgendwas machen und er hat da nicht warten können, bis die Akademiker mit einer vernünftigen Behandlungsmethode kommen. Deswegen hat er seine eigene entwickelt, die Wolfgang ja eben klar und deutlich kritisiert hat. Seine Behandlungsmethode mit Hydroxychloroquin, Azithromycin und Zinksulfat würde die würde die Replikation des RNA-Virus auf jeden Fall verhindern. Er hat sich auch umgeguckt in Südkorea, wurde auch mit Hydroxychloroquin und Zink behandelt, in einigen anderen Ländern ebenfalls. Also hat er da gesagt, daran habe ich mich orientiert und habe dann das hier versucht. Er sagt, das ist wie mit einem Ertrinkenden, der im Wasser schwimmt, der greift dann auch nach einer Planke und fragt nicht erst danach, ob die ihn halten wird, sondern wenn sie ihn hält, dann wird er danach darüber berichten, damit möglichst viele Leute das ebenfalls machen in so einer Notsituation, die er hier so gesehen hat. Dutzende von Studien würden inzwischen diese Behandlungsmethode bestätigen. Es sei zwar keine Studie, die er da gemacht hat, sondern bloß der Bericht oder die Beobachtung eines Hausarztes. Die dagegen tatsächlich existierende Peer-Reviewed Study, die es tatsächlich gab im Lancet, die hat geschrieben, dass Hydroxychloroquine hochgefährlich ist. Diese Studie musste dann allerdings zurückgezogen werden, weil sich herausgestellt hat, dass die einfach mit falschen Zahlen gearbeitet haben. Er sagt, seine Dosierung waren 400 Milligramm und die, die da benutzt wurde und die natürlich gefährlich waren, weil in der Dosis liegt das Gift, sagt man ja immer, das waren nicht 400 Milligramm, sondern 2500. In der ersten Juniwoche des letzten Jahres wurde dann die Emergency Use Authorization für Hydroxychloroquin zurückgezogen. Und das aufgrund der Studie, die er eben beschrieben hat, die längst zurückgezogen war, nämlich diese Lancet-Studie, die mit schlicht falscher Dosierung gearbeitet hat. Dann gesagt, was ist eigentlich die Emergency Use Authorization? Dachte, das ist einfach eine Goldmine für die pharmazeutische Industrie, weil sie normalerweise ja 10 Jahre braucht, um neue Medikamente zu testen und durch den Prüfprozess zu bringen. Hier ist das Ganze innerhalb von Monaten gelaufen. Um diese neuen Sachen, die man noch nicht getestet hat, in Gang zu setzen und an den Mann zu bringen, brauchte man eben diese Emergency Use Authorization. Ich hatte ja schon mal erklärt, das basiert alles auf dem Public Health Emergency of International Concern und der wiederum auf dem PCR-Test. Aber darauf sind wir eben nicht zu sprechen gekommen. 3 Wochen nachdem Hydroxychloroquine die Emergency Use Authorization zurückgezogen bekommen hat, wurde Remdesivir zugelassen mit einer Emergency Use Authorization. Und er sagt, man muss sich nur mal angucken, was das für ein Unterschied ist. Seine Behandlungsmethode, die eben auch von den Koreanern und so weiter angewendet hat, die hat zu 85% Tote und Hospitalisierung reduziert. Während Remdesivir nichts über die Reduzierung von Totenzahlen ergibt, aber ein Drittel weniger Hospitalisierung. Dafür aber eine Menge schwere Probleme als Nebenwirkung, unter anderem in der Leber. So, okay. Ja,
vielleicht dazu, ich habe ja Anfang im Frühjahr, das war schon Ende März 2020, habe ich einen Aufsatz geschrieben, der hieß Medical Detectives. Mhm. Und ich war der Erste, der das Thema Hydroxychloroquin da thematisiert hat und der die Problematik der WHO-Empfehlungen offengelegt hat. Ich habe mir nämlich die Studienregister angesehen und es gab über 1000 Studien, die gefördert wurden auch weltweit, die in dem WHO-Register drin waren. Und die alle zur Medikament oder zur Therapie von Covid-19 dann irgendwas untersuchten. Und da waren mindestens 700 bis 800 Studien, bei denen Hydroxychloroquin benutzt werden sollte. Die dort angegebenen Dosen waren so hoch, dass ich einen Schreck bekommen habe. Und ich wusste nicht nur, dass man damit die Leute zum Herzstillstand bringen kann oder zur Herzrhythmusstörung, wie das ja in Brasilien in der Studie auch passiert ist, dass bei dieser hohen Dosis. Und ich wusste aber auch, dass es Menschen gibt, die einen Enzymmangel haben, einen angeborenen Enzymmangel, der dann auch schon bei einer geringeren Dosis dazu führt, dass sie eine Hämolyse kriegen. Das ist besonders die schwarze Bevölkerung oder die Bevölkerung aus den Ländern, wo Malaria endemisch ist. Und davor habe ich gewarnt, dass man bei diesen Menschen dann Hydroxychloroquin anwendet, weil sie dann möglicherweise einfach deshalb kurzluftig werden, weil ihre roten Blutkörperchen platzen und dadurch die Kapillaren verstopfen und die ganze Symptomatik dann kommt. Das ist etwas, was offenbar Eindruck erweckt hat. Und ich habe den Eindruck, als wenn diese falsche Lancet-Studie als wenn die nur benutzt worden ist, gekauft worden ist, als falsche Studie gekauft worden ist, um dieses Manöver, dass man sehr viele kranke Patienten haben wollte, dass man sehr viele Menschen haben wollte zu Anfang dieser ganz sogenannten Pandemie, die auch sterben, um dieses Manöver wieder zu beenden, weil es durchschaut war und weil es sich rumgesprochen hatte, dass Hydroxychloroquin in der von der WHO empfohlenen Dosis, ich spreche nur von der hohen Dosis, dass das tödlich sein kann. Und mit dieser tödlichen Dosis hat man anfangs Opfer geschaffen. Es waren sehr auffällig, dass besonders auch in England die schwarze Bevölkerung sehr viel häufiger unter den Opfern war. Auch in New York waren es überwiegend dunkelhäutige Menschen, Hispanic, und es waren Schwarze, die verstorben sind. Und das waren Menschen, die Hydroxychloroquin behandelt waren. Ich weiß nicht, ob es Studien gibt, die überhaupt den Enzymmangel überhaupt berücksichtigt haben dabei. Glucose-6-Phosphat-Dehydrogenase-Mangel. Und das ist etwas, was dann auch nicht mehr diskutiert wurde, was unter den Teppich gekehrt wurde. Die WHO war froh, wegen dieser gefälschten Studie ihr Manöver, ihre Empfehlung zurückziehen zu können. So sehe ich das. Mhm. Und ich kann mir vorstellen, dass diese gefälschte Lancet-Studie, dass die fingiert war, um das zurückziehen zu können. Das ist etwas, was später mal vielleicht untersucht werden muss und später mal vielleicht dann genauer nachgeforscht werden. Den Verdacht habe ich jedenfalls. Mhm. Und das ist aber völlig was anderes als Hydroxychloroquin in der Dosis jetzt, wie Herr Dr. Zelenko das angewandt hat. Das sind eben viel weniger. Und da sind vielleicht auch toxische, bei den Phosphat-Dehydrogenase-Mangel möglicherweise Patienten, sind da auch toxische Reaktionen möglich. Aber das kann man dann sehr schnell beherrschen. Die Frage, ob es was hilft, ist eine ganz andere Frage. Und die kann ich nur beurteilen, wenn ich keine Selektion habe der Patienten. Es ist völlig klar, und ich finde es heroisch, dass viele Ärzte was ausprobiert haben zu Anfang. Und sie mussten sich natürlich dabei immer bewusst sein, dass sie eben was ausprobieren. Mhm. Und es ist sehr, sehr schwer, dann die Übersicht zu behalten. Und deshalb macht man sowas eigentlich auch mit Leuten gemeinsam, die kritisch sind, die dann praktisch das Gegenteil tun, man vergleicht sich, man ist sich nicht sicher, sondern man probiert es aus. Und ich habe einfach ein Misstrauen dann, wenn jemand sagt, ich habe hier die Patentmethode und die ist ganz toll und hat das nicht gegenkontrollieren lassen von jemand anders, der das dann auch gemacht hat und der das dann mit ähnlichen Patienten oder vielleicht noch kritischer angegangen ist. Das heißt, es fehlt mir die randomisierte Doppelblindstudie für diesen Fall. Das ist natürlich jetzt unter dem Aspekt, dass man sagt, da ist einer, der ist auf See und der ertrinkt sonst und der greift nach jeder Planke. Ja, aber geht. Berichten tun immer nur die, die nicht ertrunken sind. Egal, ob mit oder ohne Planke. Und die anderen saufen ab. Und das ist etwas, was die Ergebnisse immer verfälscht. So geht es nicht. So kriegt man keine Erkenntnis über die Wirkung, die positive oder negative Wirkung von Medikamenten.
Und das ist Goldstand. Ist denn eigentlich mal so eine Studie durchgeführt worden über Hydroxychloroquin jetzt auf der geringen Basis, eine Doppelblindstudie, ist doch irgendwie in der Zwischenzeit nicht gemacht worden, oder?
Oder gibt es das? Gibt es Studien, und ich kann nämlich immer nur auf das Arzneitelegramm, welches in Deutschland diese Studien versucht zu bewerten und eine Übersicht zu schaffen für die Ärzte in Deutschland, kann ich mich beziehen. Ich kann mich auch beziehen auf das, was ich gelesen habe in der internationalen Literatur. Und da ist es so, dass diese Studien versucht worden sind und dass die aber alle schwere Fehler hatten oder dass sie nicht peer-reviewed waren oder aber dass sie vom Ansatz her zu wenig Patienten hatten oder dass dort systemische Fehler in diesen Studien waren. Die sind also negativ bewertet worden in den Journals, die ich kenne und die ich gelesen habe. Von daher gibt es meines Wissens kein wissenschaftlich akzeptiertes Wissen darüber. Wir sind ja auch immer noch in dieser Emergency-Phase. Und Herr Dr. Zelenko hat es ja sehr deutlich gesagt, dass es hierbei darum geht, dass sehr viel Geld verdient wird. Wenn man etwas hätte, womit man jetzt Menschen bewahren könnte vor einer gefährlichen Infektion, mal vorausgesetzt, es gibt wirklich eine solche gefährliche Infektion, dann ist es natürlich klar, dass da eine gewisse Berechtigung daraus entsteht. Und sicherlich kann man auch was ausprobieren, wenn man nicht weiß, dass, oder wenn man sicher ist, dass es nicht die Leute umbringt. Aber das muss dann sehr schnell kontrolliert werden. Wir sehen ja, dass selbst die Impfungen nur dadurch die massenhaften Millionen oder milliardenfachen Impfungen von Menschen, dass die alle unter dem Label Emergency, weil das die einzige Holzplanke ist, die wir haben. Mhm. Mit dem Argument der Holzplanke werden jetzt zigtausende Menschen geschädigt und zu Tode gebracht an den Nebenwirkungen. Das ist etwas, das Argument, das lasse ich überhaupt nicht gelten. Deshalb, und das denke ich, wir dürfen nicht den wissenschaftlichen Boden und dürfen nicht die Kritik verlassen. Und wir dürfen uns auch nicht einreden, dass wir jemanden gerettet haben, wenn wir die anderen nicht sehen, die inzwischen ertrunken sind. Das ist etwas, was, ja, da müssen wir ehrlich bleiben.
Aber Wolfgang, was ja auch stark...
Wollen wir das mal eben übersetzen?
Nur ein Nachsatz. Es ist ja auch sehr befremdlich, dass eben, du sagst jetzt bei dieser, also ob das jetzt das Medikament der Wahl ist oder nicht, wenn es keine gescheiten Studien gibt, wird man das ja auch nicht final sagen können. Aber es ist ja auch merkwürdig, dass die ganzen Studien, die dann gemacht worden sind, so eine kleine Gruppe und irgendwie lauter solche, wie will man sagen, fast schon Anfängerfehler aufgewiesen zu haben scheinen, dass man eben vielleicht auch gar nicht an den Punkt ran wollte. Gibt es denn wirklich irgendeine Behandlungsmöglichkeit, ob es jetzt dies ist oder irgendwas anderes? Ja, das ist ja egal. Sondern da guckt man gar nicht so genau hin oder kommt nur mit so komischen Studien irgendwie daher, um dann eben weiterhin die Impfung als das Mittel der Lösung anzupreisen.
Wenn man davon ausgeht, dass dieser ganze Hype, alles, was wir dort jetzt als geplant, als vorbereitet, als angekündigt, was wir jetzt erleben, diese ganze Corona, wie soll ich das nennen, den Skandal, nenne ich das lieber. Und wenn ich das erlebe, wie das...
Ich glaube, wir müssen zwischendrin, wir können hier nicht einfach einen Gast in der Ecke liegen lassen. Also wir sollten vielleicht schon mal wieder ein bisschen übersetzen. Ne? Okay. Also, let me quickly translate, Dr. Zelenko.
Just one second, please. Yeah. Before you go on, I'm disoriented. This is, I've done over 500 interviews and this one is really unusual. What is the stated purpose of this interview? Is it to hear what I say or to have a debate? Because if it was a debate, I was scheduled triple the time.
No.
I need to understand.
No, the idea was to hear what you have to say. But since
it's turned into a debate, and half the time...
We're stopping this debate right now. This is getting out of hand. So that's why I'm saying, that's why I'm interrupting, and to get some time to translate what he said. Of course, we want to hear what you're saying. The thing is, there is some common ground here. Dr. Wodak published an article in one of the German medical magazines in March of 2020, and he was the first one to address the different approaches to treating this, whatever it is, be it an artificial or half artificial or whatever virus. And he was looking at between 700 and 800 studies that dealt in one way or another with hydroxychloroquine. And it turns out, and maybe this is where you can find common ground, it turns out that all of these studies involved very high doses of hydroxychloroquine. For example, there was one that was aborted in Brazil, you probably heard about it, after 13 patients died of heart failure. But it turns out all of this was extremely high doses. And in addition, there's also a problem with favism. I don't know if you know about this, but there are certain patients who cannot be treated with hydroxychloroquine. I think that's about 20 or 30% of the black or Hispanic population, those who genetically hail from countries where there's where malaria is endemic. So what I'm trying to say, Dr. Zelenko, is I don't want this to get into a fight. I just want to hear your opinion, but I'm also trying to translate what Dr. Wodak is telling us.
Okay, fine. So I'm familiar with all those studies. I believe it or not, I'm well read. And I was very careful with the dosing. And in my opinion, hydroxychloroquine, and again, I'm more interested in zinc ion, of course, but hydroxychloroquine has been around for 65 years. It's used in pregnant women. It's used in nursing mothers. It's used in children. And people use it for their entire life at 400 milligrams a day for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or for malaria prophylaxis. This drug had an established safety profile and dose schedule, which anyone with half a brain could take a look and stay within the parameters. Anyone who went outside of that was it was a malicious act to vilify and create a false narrative. But anyway, so let's go forward, because I really want to explain to you what I believe is going on. And practically, how do we save people from going forward? There are three components here. Two components. One, we have to stop the hemorrhaging. We have to stop people from dying unnecessarily. And two, hang the people that caused it. But the people who caused it, hanging them will come after we stop the people from dying. And there are two simple things that people have to know. One, stay away from a poison death shot. Do not take a vaccine that has no medical necessity, that has no efficacy, and that is extremely dangerous. So first, don't kill yourself. Don't walk into a gas chamber and take Zyklon V, V for vaccine. Don't do it. And then step number two is, if you do get sick and you fall into the high risk category, then you have to start treatment within day one or two or three, and you will be fine. That is it. That's as simple as it gets. The false narrative has created a global panic that has the real weapon of COVID-19 is the global fear that has been induced. And then the fear is used to motivate and manipulate human behavior into a course of action, such as running in an irrational way to vaccinate your children. You want to talk about child sacrifice and human sacrifice? The likelihood of children to die from COVID-19 is one in a million. The recovery rate is 99.998% with no treatment, according to the CDC. Why the hell would I vaccinate a demographic that has a near 100% recovery rate where it's safer than influenza with a poison death shot? And the answer is sacrifice of children, or whatever the rationale is. But it's not for medical reasons. Another question, why would I vaccinate someone who has natural immunity? If someone had COVID and now they have antibodies, everyone agrees that natural immunity is 100 times more effective than vaccine-induced immunity. Why would I then inject that demographic with a poison death shot? Or someone in the high-risk group that has a 7.5% chance of dying, but if you treat them appropriately, you reduce it to less than 0.5%. You know what? Let's do a mind experiment. If every single human being on the planet got COVID and was not treated, the death rate would be less than 0.5%. That's a lot of people. I'm not advocating for that. If everyone is treated, like Bill Gates said in last year, 7 billion people are going to need to be vaccinated. Do you know what the estimates are of the global death rate potentially? If you listen to Dr. Luc Montagnier, I think I said his name right, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine, discovering HIV.
Yeah, we spoke with him.
Okay, but you know what he says. He's very concerned. Mm-hmm. If you look at Dr. Michael Yeadon, who is the head of vaccine development for Pfizer.
He was the vice president of Pfizer.
Mm-hmm. What?
He was the vice president of Pfizer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for every one child, he says, for every one child that dies from COVID, 50 will die from the vaccine.
Oh.
If you look at what Dr. Malone, who invented the technology at Salk Institute in the late 80s, he has all the patents for the mRNA vaccine technology. He's telling you, don't take it. It's too dangerous, and the government is lying to you. So who the hell under those circumstances would give this to anyone?
Yeah.
And look, the two countries that are most vaccinated in the world, Israel and an island nation called Seychelles in the Indian Ocean. And both of them both have over 80% vaccination rates. Both of them are experiencing outbreaks of the Delta variant and the South African variant. So why would I give them a third shot?
That's a very good question.
There is an answer. It's not for medical reasons.
Ich hätte da noch eine wichtige Botschaft gleich hinterher, wenn du übersetzt hast.
Aber bitte nicht noch mehr hier Aufruhr. Ne?
Nein, ist okay. Alles prima.
Also, so we do have, this is what we all agree on, Dr. Zelenko. This is also, we spoke with Dr. Mike Yeadon, we spoke with Luc Montagnier, and he gave us very stark warnings that all the people who are vaccinated, all of them, unless they get saline shots, which does seem to have happened because of the side effects, which was not part of their agenda, but all of them will experience very, very serious problems. Many of them, if not all of them, will die. That's what he said. That's what he said. That's why we completely agree with you. It makes absolutely no sense at all to you're right. That's about sacrificing children. We're going to have to take a much closer look at that in the near future, because that's what it really boils down to. But you're absolutely right. There's no, virtually no risk for children to die of COVID. Why would we give them these deadly shots? Mike Yeadon is absolutely correct, but I'm not going to, I don't want to go into further detail of this, but I do. This is an area where we're in full agreement. Dr. Wodak only meant to say that after the emergency is over, if we do have an emergency, but after it's over, it's important to find out what treatment did work and what didn't, because it's only the survivors who are going to be able to tell you, yes, I grabbed that plank and that's why I survived. But all the others who didn't survive, they can't tell a story. So that's why he says we should, as soon as possible, we should conduct real studies.
So listen, I agree with you, and there's technology coming out that I'm in collaboration with that will measure real-time viral load levels of COVID-19. And we're going to set up hopefully studies with Harvard Medical School and Mass General to actually do real-time treatment, different protocols, and measure viral loads in real time to see which ones work better. That is coming. But right now, we need to stop people from dying. Yeah. And if you want to know which treatments are working, just look at my patients, okay? I'll give you an example. Out of the first group, first wave, we had 3,000 patients. Out of those 3,000 patients with COVID, I only treated 1,000. The rest of 2,000 I sent home with supportive care. Out of those 2,000, 100% survived, no one went to the hospital. So my risk stratification criteria were right on. Now, out of the 1,000, that I deem to be high risk, they fall into a death rate of 7.5%. That's the average. And we had 3 deaths. So if you expect 7.5% out of 1,075 patients, we had 3 deaths. I'm not saying 3 is insignificant, but it's several orders of magnitude less than what was expected. That was the reason why I decided to risk my life, my career, my reputation, my sanity, to bring this information to the world. Because even though I'm not a researcher, but I could recognize what is an essential piece of information that needs to be disseminated so we can stop this. The problem is that the stakeholders who have orchestrated this do not want it stopped. So in other words, take a look what's happened. Life-saving medication and life-saving information has been suppressed. Any doctor who goes against the narrative, be it Dr. Malone, who's the world expert in mRNA technology, YouTube will throw off and deplatform. So anyone who offers a dissenting opinion is deplatformed and marginalized. Right. The side effect of a poison death shot of being horrifically suppressed. I'll give you an example. And according to their system in America right now, there's 11,000 dead. That's what the government admits to. According to the 2009 Harvard study, only 1% of events are actually reported. Yeah. I can make an argument that in case of death, it would be a higher percentage. Okay, it's 20%. So the number is not 11,000, it's closer to 50,000. That's what the CDC whistleblower just said. The CDC whistleblower came out and said that there are 45,000 dead Americans.
And the but it's underreported, of course, because even in normal times, and we're not in normal times, only 1 to 10% are reported. So we're now living in times in which the mainstream media and the politicians are trying everything they can to suppress, to keep people from reporting deaths. So in reality, we're probably talking about 500,000 deaths after vaccination.
That's right. 500,000 dead Americans. I've been conservative in the media because, I mean, I agree with you. I think it is 500,000. But I say 200,000 because that's easy to guesstimate, because not only is VAERS scrubbing their system of reports that are already there, I have evidence of that where reports of death have been filed, and then now you can't find them. Mm-hmm. And then I have colleagues that are trying to file reports, and the system rejects it. So it's designed to artificially suppress the public's knowledge of the actual lethality of this poison death shot. And I want to tell you, let's talk about this in detail. There are three levels of death here. There's acute death, subacute, and long-term. Acute death is due to two things. One is the spike protein-induced blood clots. According to the Salk Institute, the body becomes a spike-producing factory. Those spikes migrate to the endothelium of your vasculature and basically destroy the platelets as they flow and cause blood clots. If it happens in the heart, it's a heart attack, right? If it happens in the brain, it's a stroke. So the main complication we're seeing from the moment of injection to around 3 months is blood clots. And 40% of those events are happening within the first 3 days from the shot. The other problem is cardiomyopathy or myocarditis in young men. And the other problem is, in first trimester pregnancies, it seems to increase the miscarriage rate by a factor of 8. That's data, that's preliminary data from the New England Journal of Medicine. That may change as more data comes in, but I'm just reporting to you what we know as of this point. When you look at the subacute concern, so that goes into the really dangerous part, something called antibody-dependent enhancement or pathogenic priming, or there's another term, PI, paradoxical immune enhancement. And that is the following concern, that in the animal models that got vaccinated, they all developed a robust immune response. But when challenged with the virus that they were immunized against, a large percentage of those animals died. And upon further investigation, it was discovered that they died from a overreaction of the immune system. Their immune system was pathologically primed and enhanced that led to the death of the animal. So you can make an argument that maybe humans are different. And my answer is maybe. But the problem is that the long-term studies have not been done to exclude this. So this is the biggest gamble of humanity in the history of humanity. And so if it takes 7 to 10 years to bring a vaccine to market on average, historically, and this one went within a year to human use. So I'm okay with that, but tell people that you're part of a human experiment.
But you know, you were speaking about the wooden piece in the ocean, and this is what the vaccine producers also use. They use the same picture you use.
That's right, except that my patients live and they're dying.
True, true.
So I have one thing I want to add. This is about what we are discussing in Germany, because we are discussing the new variants. We're causing Delta variant and such things. And they use this for reasoning that we need a new vaccine. We have to actualize it. Always new wooden pieces in the ocean. Yeah, They are always constructing them. And now we are looking for the next one. And I've seen a study from Ontario. There is a German politician. He's called Lauterbach, Karl Lauterbach. And he's always terrifying people that we have to do such things and that we have to take risk and close down everything and so on. And he used this study. And I found out that this was a study which was observing more than 200,000 patients, and they were trying to find out whether the new variant is more dangerous than the old variants. So they made some tests which variant it is and so on, and they found out, yes, really, the new variant is much more dangerous than the old one. You know, they did this study from February 7th to June 22nd. And what they really looked at comorbidities. They looked at sex and the time, pregnancy status, adjusted for age and all these things. But you know what they didn't look at? Who was vaccinated and who was not. They just leave it open. They don't speak about vaccination. It was done, this study, in the time of most active vaccinating people. And they just blinded. They don't speak about vaccination. And they use now this study, this awful study, to tell us the new variant is more dangerous. They kill the people by the vaccination. They have wrongly positive test. They have wrong positive diagnosis. And they tell us this new variant is more dangerous and we have to do more things. But if you look thoroughly at the study, they just neglect the status of being vaccinated or not, which is almost, you have to be very stupid not to see this.
So let me answer that in the following way. As you know, all the variants are essentially a change in the three-dimensional shape of the spike protein. And if the change is significant enough, antibodies from, let's say even natural antibodies to one strain may not confer immunity to another, because the ability of those antibodies to recognize a new dimension.
1,400 epitopes are recognized. Yes.
Wir sollten nicht wieder loslegen. 97% similarity between any of the all of the variants that have been found is reported by Mike Yeadon.
Listen. I have patients that have had COVID twice, and it is possible that you've had natural immunity and you can still get it again. Okay. It's much less, of course, but it is possible. But I want to tell you something. Okay. The vaccine approach is insufficient to get this problem under control.
Absolutely.
What is sufficient is the inhibition of a common pathway of all the variants. In other words, I don't really care how the virus gets into the cell. What I care about is how the virus is going to make copies of itself. And all of the variants use the same pathway of RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So if I block that pathway, I inhibit all the variants. That's why I have no fear of the variants, because the treatment approach is exactly the same.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a good closing word. Let's stick to the facts, and if whatever is tried works, let's use it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Doc. That was fun.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zelenko.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.